Book 2, On the Border, July 5th to September 6th, 1980. We come on the ship they call the Mayflower. We come on the ship that sailed the moon. We come in the age's most uncertain hour and sing an American tune. But it's all right, it's all right. You can't be forever blessed. Paul Simon. Looking hard for a drive-in, searching for a parking space, where hamburgers sizzle on an open grill night and day. Yes, jukebox is jumping with records back in the USA. Well, I'm so glad I'm living in the USA. Anything you want, we got it right here in the USA. Chuck Berry. Chapter 34. There was a dead man lying in the middle of Main Street in May, Oklahoma. Nick wasn't surprised. He had seen a lot of corpses since leaving Shoyo, and he suspected he hadn't seen a thousandth of all the dead people he must have passed. In places, the rich smell of death on the air was enough to make you feel like swooning. One more dead man, more or less, wasn't going to make any difference. But when the dead man sat up, such an explosion of terror rose in him that he again lost control of his bike. It wavered, then wobbled, then crashed, spilling Nick violently onto the pavement of Oklahoma Route 3. He cut his hands and scraped his forehead. "Holy gee, mister, but you took a tumble," the corpse said, coming toward Nick at a pace best described as an amiable stagger. "Didn't you just? My laws!" Nick got none of this. He was wondering how badly he was hurt from this second spill in less than a week. Blood from his cut forehead splattered on the pavement. When the hand touched him on the shoulder, he remembered the corpse and scrambled away on the palms of his hands and the soles of his shoes, his eyes bright with terror. "Don't you take on so," the corpse repeated. And Nick saw he was looking happily at Nick. He had most of a bottle of whiskey in one hand, and now Nick understood. Not a corpse, but a man who had gotten drunk and had passed out in the middle of the road. Nick nodded at him and made a circle with his thumb and forefinger. Then a drop of blood oozed warmly into the eye that Ray Booth had worked over, making it smart. He wiped his forearm across it, and then walked slowly to the curb and sat beside a Plymouth with Kansas plates, which was slowly settling on its tires. He could see the gash on his forehead reflected in the Plymouth's bumper. It looked ugly, but not deep. He would find the local drugstore, disinfect it, and slap a Band-Aid over it. He thought he still must have enough penicillin in his system to fight off almost anything, but his close call from the scrape on his leg had given him a horror of infection. He picked scraps of gravel out of his palms, wincing. The man with the bottle of whiskey had been watching all of this with no expression at all. If Nick had looked up, it would have struck him as queer immediately. When he had turned away to examine his wound in the bumper's reflection, the animation had leaked out of the man's face. It became empty and clean and unlined. He was wearing bibballs that were clean but faded and heavy work shoes. He stood about 5'9", and his hair was so blonde it was nearly white. His eyes were a bright, empty blue, and with the corn silk hair, his Swedish or Norwegian descent was unmistakable. He looked no more than 23, but Nick found out later he had to be 40 or close to it, because he could remember the end of World War II. And how his daddy had come home in uniform a month later. There was no question that he might have made it all up. Invention was not Tom Cullen's long suit. He stood there, empty of face, like a robot whose plug has been pulled. Then, little by little, animation seeped back into his face. His whiskey-reddened eyes began to twinkle. He smiled. He had remembered again what this situation called for. "Holy gee, mister, but you took a tumble, didn't you just? My laws!" He blinked at the amount of blood on Nick's forehead. Nick had a pad of paper and a Bic in his shirt pocket. Neither had been jarred loose by the fall. He wrote, "You just scared me. I saw two people east of here, but no one since then. Thought you were dead until you sat up. I'm okay. Is there a drugstore in town?" He showed the pad to the man in the bibballs. The man took it, looked at what was written there, handed it back. Smiling, he said, "I'm Tom Cullen, but I can't read. I only got to third grade, but then I was 16 and my daddy made me quit. He said I was too big. Retarded, Nick thought. I can't talk and he can't read. For a moment, he was utterly nonplussed.
Holy gee, mister, but you took a tumble,
Tom Cullen exclaimed. In a way, it was the first time for both of them.
My laws, didn't you just?
Nick nodded, replaced the pad and pen, put a hand over his mouth and shook his head, cupped his hands over his ears and shook his head, placed his left hand against his throat and shook his head. Cullen grinned, puzzled.
Got a toothache? I had one once. Gee, it hurt. Didn't it just? My laws.
Nick shook his head and went through his dumb show again. Cullen guessed earache this time. Nick threw his hands up and went over to his bike. The paint was scraped, but it didn't seem hurt. He got on and pedaled a little way up the street. Yes, it was all right. Cullen jogged alongside, smiling happily. His eyes never left Nick. He hadn't seen anyone for most of a week.
Don't you feel like talking?
He asked, but Nick didn't look around or appear to have heard. Tom tugged at his sleeve and repeated his question. The man on the bike put his hand over his mouth again and shook his head. Tom frowned. Now the man had put his bike on his kickstand and was looking at the storefronts. He seemed to see what he wanted because he went over to the sidewalk and then to Mr. Norton's drugstore. If he wanted to go in there, it was just too bad because the drug was locked up. Mr. Norton had left town. Just about everybody had locked up and left town, it seemed like, except for Mom and her friend Mrs. Blakely, and they were both dead. Now the no-talking man was trying the door. Tom could have told him it was no use, even though the open sign was on the door. The open sign was a liar. Too bad, because Tom would dearly have loved an ice cream soda. It was a lot better than the whiskey, which had made him feel good at first, and then made him sleepy, and then had made his head ache fit to split. He had gone to sleep to get away from the headache, but he had had a lot of crazy dreams about a man in a black suit like the one that Reverend Diefenbaker always wore. The man in the black suit chased him through the dreams. He seemed like a very bad man to Tom. The only reason he had gone to drinking in the first place was because he wasn't supposed to. His daddy had told him that, and Mom too, but now everyone was gone, so what? He would if he wanted to.
But what was the no-talking man doing now?
Picked up the litter basket from the sidewalk, and he was going to...
What? Break Mr. Norton's window?
Crash!
By God and by damn if he didn't.
And now he was reaching through, unlocking the door.
Hey, mister, you can't do that,
Tom cried, his voice throbbing with outrage and excitement.
That's illegal. M-O-O-N, and that spells illegal. Don't you know?
But the man was already inside, and he never turned around.
What are you, anyway, deaf?
Tom called indignantly.
My laws, are you...
He trailed off. The animation and excitement left his face. He was the robot with the pulled plug again. In May, it had not been an uncommon sight to see feeble Tom like this. He would be walking along the street, looking into shop windows with that eternally happy expression on his slightly rounded, Scandahoovian face, and all of a sudden he would stop dead and go blank. Someone might shout, "There goes Tom," and there would be laughter. If Tom's daddy was with him, he would scowl and elbow Tom, perhaps even sock him repeatedly on the shoulder or the back until Tom came to life. But Tom's daddy had been around less and less after the first half of 1979, because he was stepping out with a red-headed waitress who worked at Boomer's Bar and Grill. Her name was Dee Dee Packalot, and weren't there some jokes about that name? And about a year ago, she and Don Cullen had run off together. Most folks took Tom's sudden blankouts as a further sign of retardation. But they were actually instances of nearly normal thinking. Tom Cullen was not severely retarded, and he was capable of making simple connections. Every now and then, during his blankouts, he would be capable of making a more sophisticated inductive or deductive connection. He would feel the possibility of making such a connection the way a normal person will sometimes feel a name dancing right on the tip of his tongue. When it happened, Tom would dismiss his real world, which was nothing more or less than an instant-by-instant flow of sensory input, and go into his mind. He would be like a man in a dark and unfamiliar room who holds the plug end of a lamp cord in one hand and who is crawling around on the floor, bumping into things and feeling with his free hand for the electrical socket. And if he found it, he didn't always. There would be a burst of illumination, and he would see the room, or the idea, plain. Tom was a sensory creature. A list of his favorite things would have included the taste of an ice cream soda at Mr. Norton's fountain, watching a pretty girl in a short dress waiting on the corner to cross the street, the smell of lilac, the feel of silk. But more than any of these things, he loved the intangible. He loved that moment when the connection would be made, the switch cleared, at least momentarily. The light would go on in the dark room. It didn't always happen. Often the connection eluded him. This time it didn't. He had said, "What are you anyway, deaf?" The man hadn't acted like he heard what Tom was saying, except for those times he had been looking right at him. And the man hadn't said anything to him, not even hi. Sometimes people didn't answer Tom when he asked questions because something in his face told them he was soft upstairs. But this man didn't act like that was the reason. He had given Tom a circle made of his thumb and forefinger, and Tom knew that meant okie-dokie. But still he didn't talk. Hands over his ears and a shake of his head. Hands over his mouth and the same. Hands over his neck and the same again. "My laws," Tom said. And the animation came back into his face. His bloodshot eyes glowed. He rushed into Norton's drugstore, forgetting that it was illegal to do so. The bike man was squirting something that smelled like Bactine into cotton and then wiping the cotton on his forehead. "Hey, mister," Tom said, rushing up. The bike man didn't turn around. Tom was momentarily puzzled, and then he remembered. He tapped Nick on the shoulder, and Nick turned. "You're deaf and dumb, right? Can't hear, can't talk, right?" Nick nodded. And to him, Tom's reaction was nothing short of amazing. He jumped into the air and clapped his hands wildly. "I thought of it! Hooray for me! I thought of it myself! Hooray for Tom Cullen!" Nick had to grin. He couldn't remember when his disability had brought someone so much pleasure. Nick slept in the park that night. He didn't know where Tom slept, but when he woke up the next morning, slightly dewy but feeling pretty good otherwise, the first thing he saw when he crossed the town square was Tom, crouched over a fleet of toy corgi cars and a large plastic Texaco station. He walked across the street and tapped Tom on the arm. Tom jumped and looked over his shoulder. A large and guilty smile stretched his lips, and a blush climbed out of his shirt collar. "I know it's for little boys and not for grown men," he said. "I know that. Laws, yes, Daddy told me." Nick shrugged, smiled, spread his hands. Tom looked relieved. "It's mine now. Mine if I want it. If you could go in the drug and get something, so could I. I don't have to put it back, do I?" Nick shook his head. "Mine," Tom said happily, and turned back to the garage. Nick tapped him again, and Tom looked back. "What?" Nick tugged his sleeve, and Tom stood up willingly enough. Nick led him down the street to where his bike leaned on its kickstand. He pointed to himself, then at the bike. Tom nodded. "Sure, that bike is yours. That Texaco garage is mine. I won't take your bike and you won't take my garage. Laws, no." Nick shook his head. He pointed at himself, at the bike, then down Main Street. He waved his fingers. "Bye-bye." Tom became very still. Nick waited. Tom said hesitantly, "You moving on, mister?" Nick nodded. "I don't want you to," Tom burst out. His eyes were wide and very blue, sparkling with tears. "I like you. I don't want you to go." Nick nodded. He pulled Tom next to him and put an arm around him, pointed to himself, to Tom, to the bike, out of town. "I don't get you," Tom said. Patiently, Nick went through it again. This time he added the bye-bye wave, and in a burst of inspiration, he lifted Tom's hand and made it wave bye-bye, too. "Want me to go with you?" Tom asked. A smile of disbelieving delight lit up his face. Relieved, Nick nodded.
Sure, Tom shouted. Tom Cullen's gonna go. Tom's...
He halted, some of the happiness dying out of his face.
Can I take my garage?
Nick thought about it a moment, and then nodded his head.
Okay.
Tom's grin reappeared like the sun from behind a cloud. Tom Cullen's going. Nick led him to the bike. He pointed at Tom, then at the bike.
I never rode one like that,
Tom said doubtfully, eyeing the bike's gear shift and the high, narrow seat.
I guess I better not. Tom Cullen would fall off a fancy bike like that.
But Nick was provisionally encouraged. I never rode one like that meant that he had ridden some sort of bike. It was only a question of finding a nice, simple one. Tom was going to slow him down, that was inevitable, but perhaps not too much after all. And what was the hurry, anyway? Dreams were only dreams. But he did feel an inner urge to hurry, something so strong yet undefinable that it amounted to a subconscious command. He led Tom back to his filling station. He pointed at it, then smiled and nodded at Tom. Tom squatted down eagerly, and then his hands paused in the act of reaching for a couple of cars. He looked up at Nick, his face troubled and transparently suspicious.
You ain't gonna go without Tom Cullen, are you?
Nick shook his head firmly.
Okay,
Tom said, and turned confidently to his toys. Before he could stop himself, Nick had ruffled the man's hair. Tom looked up and smiled shyly at him. Nick smiled back. No, he couldn't just leave him. That was sure. It was almost noon before he found a bike which he thought would suit Tom. He hadn't expected it to take anywhere near as long as it did, but a surprising majority of people had locked their houses, garages, and outbuildings. In most cases, he was reduced to peering into shadowy garages through dirty, cobwebby windows, hoping to spot the right bike. At one point, he had gone back to recheck the Western Auto, but that was no good. The two bikes in the show window were his and hers 3-speeds, and everything else was unassembled. In the end, he found what he was looking for in a small detached garage at the southern end of town. The garage was locked, but it had one window big enough to crawl through. Nick broke the glass with a rock and carefully picked the remaining slivers out of the old crumbling putty. Inside the garage was explosively hot and furry with a thick oil and dust smell. The bike, an old-fashioned boy's Schwinn, stood next to a 10-year-old Merck station wagon. The way my luck's running, the damn bike will be busted, Nick thought. No chain, flat tires, something. But this time his luck was in. The bike rolled easily. The tires were up and had good tread. All the bolts and sprockets seemed tight. There was no bike basket. He would have to remedy that, but there was a chain guard and hung neatly on the wall, an unexpected bonus, a nearly new Briggs hand pump. He tied the bike pump to the package carrier on the Schwinn's back fender with a hank of hay rope, then unlocked the garage door and ran it up. Fresh air had never smelled so sweet. He closed his eyes and inhaled it deeply, then wheeled the bike out to the road, got on, and pedaled slowly down Main Street. The bike rode fine. It would be just the ticket for Tom, assuming he really could ride it. He parked it beside his Raleigh and went into the 5 and Dime. He found a good-sized wire bike basket in a jumble of sporting goods near the back of the store, and was turning to leave with it under his arm when something else caught his eye. A klaxon horn with a chrome bell and a large red rubber bulb. Grinning, Nick put the horn in the basket and then went over to the hardware section for a screwdriver and an adjustable wrench. He went back outside. Tom was sprawled peacefully in the shade of the World War II Marine in the town square, napping. He put the basket on the Schwinn's handlebars and attached the klaxon horn beside it. He went back into the 5 and Dime and came out with a good-sized tote bag. He took it up to the A&P and filled it with canned meat, fruit, and vegetables. He was pausing over some canned chili beans when he saw a shadow flit by on the aisle facing him. If he had been able to hear, he would already have been aware that Tom had discovered his bike. The klaxon's hoarse and drawn-out cry of, "Howga!" floated up and down the street, punctuated by Tom Cullen's giggles. Nick pushed out through the supermarket stores and saw Tom speeding grandly down Main, his blonde hair and his shirt tail whipping out behind him, squeezing the bulb of the klaxon horn for all it was worth. At the Arco station that marked the end of the business section, he whirled around and pedaled back. There was a huge and triumphant grin on his face. The Fisher-Price garage sat in the bike basket. His pants pockets and the flap pockets of his khaki shirt bulged with scale model Corgi cars. The sun flashed bright, revolving circles in the wheel spokes. A little wistfully, Nick wished he could hear the sound of the horn, just to see if it pleased him as much as it was pleasing Tom. Tom brought the bike to a skidding halt in front of Nick. Sweat stood out on his face in great beads. The bike pump's rubber hose flopped. Tom was panting and grinning. Nick pointed out of town and waved bye-bye. "Can I still take my garage?" Nick nodded and slipped the strap of the tote bag over Tom's bull neck. "We going right now?" Nick nodded again. He made a circle with his thumb and forefinger. "Wow," Tom said happily. "Okay, yeah, wow." Nick went back to his own bike, slipped into his pack, and got on. Tom watched him ride up, his face alight with furious anticipation. Nick clapped him on the shoulder. They rode out of town side by side, Tom still squeezing the bulb of his horn. They camped that night in left field of the Roston J.C.'s Little League ball field. The evening was cloudless and starry. Nick's sleep came quickly and was dreamless. He woke up at dawn next morning, thinking how good it was to be with someone again, what a difference it made. He had a battered Rand McNally Road Atlas in his pack, and while he waited for Tom to wake up, he sat cross-legged in a sleeping bag lifted from the Roston Sporting Goods and tried to plot a course. There really was a Polk County, Nebraska. At first, that had given him a start. But he had traveled all over the last few years. He must have talked to somebody who mentioned Polk County or had come from Polk County, and his conscious mind had just forgotten it. There was a Route 30, too. But he couldn't really believe, at least not in the bright day of this early morning, that they were actually going to find an old Negro woman sitting on her porch in the middle of a field of corn and accompanying herself on a guitar while she sang hymns. He didn't believe in precognition or in visions, but it seemed important to go somewhere to look for people. In a way, he shared Fran Goldsmith's and Stu Redmond's urge to regroup. Until that could be done, everything would remain alien and out of joint. There was danger everywhere. You couldn't see it, but you could feel it. Danger. Every particle of his being seemed to whisper it. Bridge out. 40 miles of bad road. We are not responsible for persons proceeding beyond this point. Part of it was the tremendous, walloping psychological shock of the empty countryside. He remembered a Walt Disney movie he had seen as a kid. A nature thing. Filling the screen was this tulip. This one tulip. So beautiful it just made you want to hold your breath. Then the camera pulled back with dizzying suddenness, and you saw a whole field filled with tulips. It knocked you flat. It produced total sensory overload, and some internal circuit breaker fell with a sizzle, cutting off the input. It was too much. And that was how this trip had been. Shoyo was empty, and he could adjust to that. But McNabb was empty, too, and Texarkana, and Spencerville. Ardmore had burned right to the ground. He had come north on Highway 81 and had only seen two living people, and they had run away from him like deer. Twice he had seen signs, a campfire perhaps 2 days old, and a deer that had been shot and neatly cleaned out. But no people. It was enough to screw you all up, because the enormity of it was steadily creeping up on you. It wasn't just Shoyo or McNabb or Texarkana. It was America, lying there like a huge discarded tin can with a few forgotten peas rolling around in the bottom. And beyond America was the whole world. And thinking of that made Nick feel so dizzy and sick that he had to give up. He bent over the atlas. If they kept rolling, maybe there would be like a snowball going downhill, getting bigger. With any luck, they would pick up a few more people between here and Nebraska, or be picked up themselves if they met a larger group. After Nebraska, he supposed they would go somewhere else. It was like a quest with no object in view at the end of it. No grail, No sword plunged into an anvil. We'll cut northeast, he thought, up into Kansas. Highway 35 would take them to another version of 81, and 81 would take them all the way to Swedenholm, Nebraska, where it intersected Nebraska Route 92 at a perfect right angle. Another highway, Route 30, connected the two, the hypotenuse of a right triangle. And somewhere in that triangle was the country of his dream. Thinking about it gave him a queer, anticipatory thrill. Movement at the top of his vision made him look up. Tom was sitting, both fists screwed into his eyes. A cavernous yawn seemed to make the whole bottom half of his face disappear. Nick grinned at him, and Tom grinned back. "We gonna ride some more today?" Tom asked, and Nick nodded. "Gee, that's good. I like to ride my bike. Laws, yes. I hope we never stop." Putting the atlas away, Nick thought, "And who knows? You may get your wish." They turned east that morning and ate their lunch at a crossroads not far from the Oklahoma-Kansas border. It was July 7th and hot. They crossed into Kansas just before it got too dark to ride any further. Tom had turned sulky and tired after supper. He wanted to play with his garage. He wanted to watch TV. He didn't want to ride anymore because his bum hurt from the seat. He had no conception of state lines and felt none of the lift Nick did when they passed the sign saying, "You are now entering Kansas." By then, the dusk was so thick that the white letters seemed to float inches above the brown sign, like spirits. They camped a quarter of a mile over the line, beneath a water tower standing on tall steel legs like an H.G. Wells Martian. Tom was asleep as soon as he crawled into a sleeping bag. Nick sat a while watching the stars come out. The land was utterly dark, and for him, utterly still. Shortly before crawling in himself, a crow fluttered down to a fence post nearby and seemed to be watching him. Its small black eyes were rimmed with half circles of blood, reflection from a bloated orange summer moon that had risen silently. There was something about the crow Nick didn't like. It made him uneasy. He found a big dirt clod and pegged it at the crow. It fluttered its wings, seemed to fix him with a baleful glare, and was gone into the night. That night he dreamed of the man with no face, standing on the high roof, his hands stretched out to the east, and then of the corn higher than his head, and the sound of the music. Only this time he knew it was music, and this time he knew it was a guitar. He awoke near dawn with a painfully full bladder, and her words ringing in his ears. "Mother Abigail is what they call me. You come see me any time." They ran across Julie Lowry on July 10th. The day was another scorcher. They had pedaled most of the afternoon with their shirts tied around their waists, and both of them were getting as brown as Indians. They hadn't been making very good time, not today, because of the apples, the green apples. They had found them growing on an old apple tree in a farmyard, green and small and sour, but they had both been deprived of fresh fruit for a long time, and they tasted ambrosial. Nick made himself stop after two, but Tom ate six, greedily, one after the other, right down to the cores. He had ignored Nick's motions that he should stop. When he got an idea in his head, Tom Cullen could be every bit as attractive as a wayward child of four. So, beginning around 11 in the morning and continuing through the rest of the afternoon, Tom had the squats. Sweat ran off him in small creeks. He groaned. He had to get off his bike and walk it up even shallow hills. Despite his irritation at the poor time they were making, Nick couldn't help a certain rueful amusement. When they reached the town of Pratt around 4 p.m., Nick decided that was it for the day. Tom collapsed gratefully on a bus stop bench that was in the shade and dozed off at once. Nick left him there and went along the deserted business section in search of a drugstore. He would get some Pepto-Bismol and force Tom to drink it when he woke up, whether Tom wanted it or not. If it took a whole bottle to cork Tom up, so be it. Nick wanted to make up some time tomorrow. He found a Rexall between the Pratt Theater and the local Norge. He slipped in through the open door and stood for a moment smelling the familiar, hot, unaired, stale smell. There were other odors mixed in, strong and cloying. Perfume was the strongest. Perhaps some of the bottles had burst in the heat. Nick glanced around, looking for the stomach medicines, trying to remember if Pepto-Bismol went over in the heat. Well, the label would say. His eyes slipped past a mannequin, and two rows to the right he saw what he wanted. He had taken two steps that way when he realized the mannequin wasn't a mannequin. She was standing perfectly still, a bottle of perfume in one hand, the small glass wand you use to daub the stuff on in the other. Her china blue eyes were wide in stunned, disbelieving surprise. Her brown hair was drawn back and tied with a brilliant silk scarf that hung halfway down her back. She was wearing a pink midi sweater and blue jeans shorts that were almost abbreviated enough to be mistaken for panties. There was a rash of pimples on her forehead. She and Nick stared at each other across half the length of the deserted drugstore, both frozen now. Then the bottle of perfume dropped from her fingers, shattered like a bomb, and drowned out the scent of the others at once.
"Jesus, are you real?" she asked in a trembling voice.
Nick nodded.
"You ain't a ghost?"
He shook his head.
"Then say something. If you ain't a ghost, say something."
Nick put a hand across his mouth, then on his throat. He shook his head. She took two steps toward him, gaping.
"You can't talk? You're a mute?"
Nick nodded. She gave a high laugh that was mostly frustration.
"You mean somebody finally showed up and it's a mute guy?"
Nick shrugged and gave a slanting smile.
"Well," she said, coming down the aisle to him, "you ain't bad looking, that's something."
She put a hand on his arm, and the swell of her breasts almost touched his arm. He could smell at least three different kinds of perfume, and under all of them the unlovely aroma of her sweat.
"My name's Julie," she said. "Julie Lowry. What's yours?"
She giggled a little.
"You can't tell me, can you? Poor you."
She leaned a little closer, and her breasts brushed him. He began to feel very warm. "What the hell," he thought uneasily. "She's only a kid." He broke away from her, took the pad from his pocket, and began to write. A line or so into his message, she leaned over his shoulder to see what he was writing. "No bra. Jesus." His writing became a little uneven. "I'm Nick Andros. I'm a deaf mute. I'm traveling with a man named Tom Cullen, who is lightly retarded. He can't read or understand many of the things I can act out unless they're very simple. We're on our way to Nebraska because I think there might be people there. Come with us if you want."
"Sure,"
she said immediately. And then, remembering that he was deaf and shaping her words very carefully, she asked, "Can you read lips?" Nick nodded.
"Okay,"
she said. "I'm so glad to see someone. Who cares if it's a deaf mute and a retard? Spooky here. I can hardly sleep nights since the power went off. My mom and dad died 2 weeks ago, you know. Everybody died but me. I've been so lonely." With a sob, she threw herself into Nick's arms and began to undulate against him in an obscene parody of grief. When she drew back from him, her eyes were dry and shiny.
"Hey, let's make it," she said. "You're sort of cute."
Nick gawped at her.
"I can't believe this," he thought.
But it was real enough. She was tugging at his belt.
"Come on, I'm on the pill. It's safe."
She paused for a moment.
"You can, can't you? I mean, just because you can't talk, that doesn't mean you can't..."
He put his hands out, perhaps meaning to take her by the shoulders, but he found her breasts instead. That was the end of any resistance he might have had. Coherent thought left his mind as well. He lowered her to the floor and had her. After, he went to the door and looked out as he buckled his belt again, checking on Tom. He was still on the park bench, dead to the world. Julie joined him, fiddling with a fresh bottle of perfume. "That the retard?" she asked. Nick nodded, not liking the word. It seemed like a cruel word. She began to talk about herself, and Nick discovered to his relief that she was 17, not much younger than he was. She talked a lot, and he found it next to impossible to separate the truth from the lies, or the wish fulfillment, if you preferred. She might have been waiting for someone like him who could never interrupt the endless flow of her monologue all her life. In the space of an hour, incredibly, he found himself wishing he hadn't found her in the first place, or that she would change her mind about coming with them. When the flow of words had begun to dry up a little, at least for the time being, she wanted to do it, as she so coyly put it, again. Nick shook his head, and she pouted briefly. "Maybe I don't want to go with you after all," she said. Nick shrugged. "Dummy, dummy, dummy," she said with sudden sharp viciousness. Her eyes shone with spite. Then she smiled. "I didn't mean that. I was just kidding." Nick wondered. "Uh-uh," Tom said, shaking his head and backing away. "Uh-uh, I ain't gonna. Tom Cullen doesn't like medicine. Laws, no, tastes bad." Nick looked at him with frustration and disgust, holding the three-sided bottle of Pepto-Bismol in one hand. He looked to Julie, and she caught his gaze, but in it he saw that same teasing light as when she had called him dummy. It was not a twinkle, but a hard and mirthless shine. It was the look that a person with no essential sense of humor gets in his or her eye when he or she is getting ready to tease. "That's right, Tom," she said. "Don't drink it. It's poison." Nick gaped at her. She grinned back, hands on hips, challenging him to convince Tom otherwise. This was her petty revenge, perhaps, for having her second offer of sex turned down. He looked back at Tom and swigged from the Pepto-Bismol bottle himself. He could feel the dull pressure of anger at his temples. He held the bottle out to Tom, but Tom was not convinced. "No, Tom Cullen doesn't drink poison," he said. And with rising fury at the girl, Nick saw that Tom was terrified. "Daddy said don't. Daddy said if it'll kill the rats in the barn, it'll kill Tom. No poison." Nick suddenly half-turned to Julie, unable to bear her smug grin. He hit her open-handed, hit her hard. Tom stared, eyes wide and scared. "You," she began, and for a moment she couldn't find the words. Her face flushed thinly, and she suddenly looked scrawny and spoiled and vicious. "You dummy freak bastard! It was just a joke, you shithead! You can't hit me! You can't hit me, goddamn you!" She lunged at him, and he pushed her backward. She fell on the seat of her denim shorts and stared up at him, lips pulled back in a snarl. Hands trembling, head pounding now, Nick took his pad and pen out and scrawled a note out in large, jagged letters. He tore it off and held it out to her. Eyes glaring and furious, she batted it aside. He picked it up, grabbed the back of her neck, and shoved the note into her face. Tom had withdrawn, whimpering. She screamed, "All right, I'll read it. I'll read your crappy note." It was four words. "We don't need you." "Fuck you," she cried, tearing herself out of his grasp. She backed several steps down the sidewalk. Her eyes were as wide and blue as they had been in the drugstore when he almost literally stumbled over her, but now they were spitting with hate. Nick felt tired. Of all the possible people, why her? "I'm not staying here," Julie Lowry said. "I'm coming, and you can't stop me." But he could. Didn't she realize that yet? No, Nick thought, she didn't. To her, all of this was some sort of Hollywood scenario, a living disaster movie in which she had the starring part. He drew the revolver from its holster and pointed it at her feet. She became very still, and the flush evaporated from her face. Her eyes changed, and she looked very different, somehow real for the first time. Something had entered her world that she could not, at least in her own mind, manipulate to her advantage. A gun. Nick felt suddenly sick as well as tired. "I didn't mean it," she said rapidly. "I'll do anything you want, honest to God." He motioned her away with the gun. She turned and began to walk, looking back over her shoulder. She walked faster and faster, then broke into a run. She turned the corner a block up and was gone. Nick holstered the gun. He was trembling. He felt soiled and depressed, as if Julie Lowry had been something inhuman, more akin to the trundling and cold-blooded beetles you find under dead trees than to other human beings. He turned around, looking for Tom, but Tom wasn't in sight. It took him almost 20 minutes to find him. He was crouched on a back porch 2 streets down from the business section. He was sitting on a rusty porch glider, his Fisher-Price garage cradled to his chest. When he saw Nick, he began to cry.
"Please don't make me drink it. Please don't make Tom Cullen drink poison. Laws, no. Daddy said if it would kill the rats, it would kill me. Please."
Nick saw that he was still holding the bottle of Pepto-Bismol. He threw it away and spread his empty hands in front of Tom. His diarrhea would just have to run its course. Tom came down the porch steps, blubbering.
"I'm sorry," he said over and over. "I'm sorry, Tom Cullen, sorry."
They walked back to Main Street together and came to a halt, staring. Both bikes were overturned. The tires had been slashed. The contents of their packs had been strewn from one side of the street to the other. Just then, something passed at high speed close to Nick's face. He felt it, and Tom shrieked and began to run. Nick stood puzzled for a moment, looking around, and happened to be looking in the right direction to see the muzzle flash of the second shot. It came from a second-story window of the Pratt Hotel. Something like a high-speed darning needle tugged at the fabric of his shirt collar. He turned and ran after Tom. He had no way of knowing if Julie fired again. All he knew for sure when he caught up with Tom was that neither of them had been shot. At least we're shut of that Helgen, he thought. But that turned out to be only half true. They slept in a barn 3 miles north of Pratt that evening, and Tom kept waking up with nightmares and then waking Nick to be reassured. They reached Iuka the next morning around 11 and found two good bicycles in a shop called Sport and Cycle World. Nick, who was beginning to recover at last from the encounter with Julie, thought they could finish re-outfitting themselves in Great Bend, which they should reach by the 14th at the latest. But at just about 2:45 on the afternoon of July 12th, he saw a twinkle in the rearview mirror mounted near his left-hand grip. He stopped. Tom, who was riding behind him in wool-gathering, ran over his foot, but Nick barely noticed, and looked back over his shoulder. The twinkle that had risen over the hill directly behind them like a day star pleased and dazzled his eye. He could hardly believe it. It was a Chevy pickup of ancient vintage, picking its way slowly, slaloming from one lane of U.S. 281 to the other, avoiding a scatter of stalled vehicles. The face that appeared belonged to a 40-ish man wearing a straw hat with a feather cocked into the blue velvet band at a rakish angle. And when he grinned, his face became a dry wash of agreeable sun wrinkles. And what he said was, "Holy Christ on a carousel, am I glad to see you boys? I guess I am. Climb on up here and let's see where we're going." That was how Nick and Tom met Ralph Brentner.